for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Americans generate about 4 pounds of trash per person per day. Some research shows that recycling in many parts of the country is not keeping up with the amount of garbage produced. Some cities and counties are considering building new incinerators to handle all the trash. Here to talk about the pros and cons of these facilities, Paul Gilman with Covanta, Danielle Bosson with the Center for American Progress, and Eric Schaefer at the Environmental Integrity Project. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Good to see you. Danielle, tell us about these waste-to-energy incinerators. I gather they aim to do two things, waste disposal and create energy.
That's correct. Waste-to-energy incinerators can resolve can be part of the solution for two problems that we have. One is a landfill problem. As you mentioned earlier, we are producing over 4 pounds of garbage per day per person. That results in over 250 million tons of garbage per year. And what happens is, if we're lucky, that goes into a landfill. Actually, if we're very lucky, it doesn't go into a landfill at all. But it either goes into a landfill or it gets caught in our wastewater systems and sewer systems. We do have strong recycling programs, but unfortunately, they do not solve the entire problem. So waste-to-energy plants can reduce the landfills and the associated methane emissions from those landfills that cause climate change. They can also produce a cleaner form of energy than some fossil fuel-based energy sources.
And Paul, you are a senior vice president of Covanta, and that's one of the largest operators of these plants. How many are in operation? How do they work?
Oh, well, there are a large number in Europe, for example, or about over 400 in Europe, over 300 in Asia. In the U.S., they're just over 80. The U.S. Has a very different approach to waste. While we profess reduce, reuse, recycle, recover energy, and then landfill, we're one of the biggest landfilling countries in the world. 70% of our waste go into landfill. Compare that to like a Germany where they recycle 70%. The plants operate using as a fuel the post-recycled waste in a community. It generates steam. That steam creates electricity by going through a turbine. After you've combusted the waste, you can recover metals from it, sort of the third benefit of creating electricity this way is that we recover a considerable amount of metals. We last year recovered enough aluminum to make 1 billion aluminum cans, for example.
I gather the plants are quite expensive, which may suggest why there are so few here in this country, whereas Europe and Japan have many more?
Well, they are expensive. They are doing two things. They're processing waste and they're also making electricity. When you consider the revenues and the ultimate cost of electricity, it's quite competitive. It's the cost of electricity is cheaper than other renewables like wind and photovoltaics, but probably it's policy that makes the difference between the U.S. and the European Union, for example. The European Union is driven largely by a desire to reduce greenhouse gases, and that meant for them getting the material in your waste that degrades in landfills and creates methane out of those landfills. So they put a significant tax on landfills and placing that biodegradable material in the landfill.
And Derek Schaefer of the Environmental Integrity Project. I gather you have real concerns about these emissions, especially mercury and lead.
We do. I think we're in the middle of a sales campaign for these waste-to-energy plants. A number of them have been proposed. And when you hear those arguments, you need to be sure before making a decision that you're looking at the full deck of cards. Everything should be face up on the table. So the first issue or the first assumption that we've topped out on recycling, there's not much more we can do. I don't think that's true at all. I haven't seen data to support that. The rate of recycling has slowed, but we've had no increase in waste-to-energy plants in the last 10 or 15 years.
So Tell me why the recycling process has slowed.
We had rapid growth starting in the 1980s, and between the 80s and today, we've just about tripled recycling rates. And so when you have that kind of rapid increase, it doesn't surprise me that, especially with the recession and, you know, the issues cities are struggling with, that you've had a slowdown in the rate of growth. That does not make waste-to-energy plants the answer.
But haven't many of the recycling companies simply gotten out of the business because it wasn't profitable enough?
Well, if you want to look at pure economics, you've got the bankruptcy of the Harrisburg waste-to-energy incinerator. You've got a Palm Beach Post story, I think I'm quoting the right paper, maybe another one, reporting that the new incinerator there is not getting, and I'm quoting, paraphrasing from a spokesman for the Solid Waste Authority there, they're not getting the business that they expected. So, you know, you have local hits on both recycling and waste-to-energy, but you've had growth in recycling. That's what I think you need to look at the overall curve. And over the last 5 or 6 years, it's gone from 30 to 31% to 34%. So it's increasing more slowly. We need to do more, especially if we're going to put incentives and public money together. Those should go to recycling.
But tell me about the concerns you have regarding emissions.
So first issue, when you think about emissions, there's methane from landfills and there's carbon dioxide that you get from burning waste. Those are both global warming pollutants, and we need to do everything we can to reduce them. If you compare a modern waste-to-energy plant to a modern landfill, which, by the way, usually has a system to recover methane and to get some energy production out of it, I don't see, in terms of greenhouse gases, any big advantage for waste-to-energy plants. If you look at EPA's methods for calculating greenhouse gas emissions, which they post online, under most scenarios, you're better off putting tires, newspapers, and plastics in landfills from a greenhouse gas perspective than you are burning it. And that's not something you hear. So looking at the data closely and trying to understand where the balance is really important. And, you know, there may be a slight advantage when it comes to greenhouse gases when you look at the total waste stream. But really what you want to be comparing is waste to energy as one alternative and recycling as much as you can and landfilling the rest as the second alternative.
How do you feel about that, Paul? Is that a fair parallel?
Well, it's not just how I feel about it. It's how the European Union climate scientists feel about it. Yes, you should optimize your recycling. That, you know, the wonderful model that the Northern Europe has sort of adopted where recycling rates are 50, 60, 70%. But you shouldn't then resort to landfilling after that. That's the
Why not?
Lower priority. The generation of the methane gas, which is a potent greenhouse gas, current numbers use that it's 34 times the potency of carbon dioxide as a greenhouse gas. So by sending your waste to that landfill where it generates methane, you're adding to the problem. When you take the waste after recycling and send it to an energy recovery facility like we operate, you are avoiding that methane. You're also backing fossil-fired power out of the grid when you produce power with that waste. And the rule of thumb that the US EPA uses, that for every ton of waste you process, you're reducing greenhouse gases by a ton. That's not insignificant. If we could be more like Europe in terms of, oh, say, a recycling rate of 60%, energy recovery for, say, 30%, and if we had to landfilling no more than 10%, we could save greenhouse gases on the order of 1 billion tons a year. That's not insignificant. In order to get 1 billion tons, we'd have to double nuclear power plant capacity.
Paul Yeltman, he's Chief Sustainability Officer and Senior Vice President at Covanta. That's one of the largest waste-to-energy companies in the world. Short break, right back.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. From A24, presenting Ex Machina, a new artificial intelligence thriller from Alex Garland, the writer of 28 Days Later and Sunshine. Ex Machina, now playing everywhere. And from the Roth Family Foundation, investing in organizations that inspire hope, dignity, and creativity, working to connect communities to the services, opportunities, and tools for self-empowerment and self-expression. Learn more at RothFamilyFoundation.org.
And joining us now by phone from West Palm Beach, Florida, Mark Hammond. He's executive director of the County Solid Waste Authority. The county just built a new garbage-to-energy plant for $670 million. Thanks for joining us, Mark. Tell us why your county decided to build this incinerator. I gather the alternative was a landfill near a wildlife refuge.
Oh, that's correct. We were looking at our disposal options. The existing landfill was going to reach capacity probably around 2022 or 2023. So we began permitting for a facility in western Palm Beach County. We've got significant pushback from citizens and environmental community about building that landfill. So we began to explore other options. Just to give you a little history, the Solid Waste Authority operates an integrated solid waste management system. We have landfills. We have an existing waste energy facility that's been in operation since 1989, plus we have a very aggressive materials recovery program for capturing materials from residential and commercial units that's processed for recycling. As part of our decision-making process, because of the inability to site, the landfill, we began to explore ways to energy. And our board said, you know, this makes sense for us.
But I gather that the facility costs $670 million to build. Was that cheaper than maintaining a landfill?
Well, if you look at the economics of it, our rates for operating this waste energy facility are very comparable to landfill rates in areas of the country. For example, our cost to operate this new $670 million plant will be right in the neighborhood of $50 per ton, and that's fully loaded cost. That's debt service, that's the operating fee, but netted against what we would achieve from the sale of electricity.
And tell me what locals are primarily concerned about.
Well, actually, we had very little opposition to expanding waste energy here in Palm Beach County. I must say that as part of our permitting process, we were required to send out 65,000 first-class notices to everybody within a three-mile radius of where this project was going to be built, and we received 15 responses to those 65,000 first-class notices.
I gather the waste-to-energy plant does emit some lead and sulfur dioxide and other pollutants. What happens to those?
Well, as has been mentioned and already discussed, through our permitting process, we had to guarantee to the state that we would have a very, very aggressive air pollution control system put in place. And the state put together very specific conditions under which we must operate, with maximum thresholds for certain constituents. And we certainly met all of these and will meet all of these and are going to be substantially under what these permit requirements are.
Mark Hammond, Executive Director of the Solid Waste Authority of Palm Beach County, Florida. Thanks for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
Turning to you, Eric Schaefer, what do you think of what they've done in Florida?
Well, first, as I said earlier, the reports in the news are the revenue that they expect that is not materializing. So they are now taking waste from beyond the county, which means it has to be hauled from further away. I don't think people are going to be too happy about that. But let's turn to the environmental footprint. You hear things like maximum threshold and so on. It sounds very, important. But look at the numbers. They're permitted to release 110 pounds of mercury a year. The amount of mercury in a thermometer, which is about 1/70th of a teaspoon, will contaminate a 25-acre lake, make the fish unsafe to eat. They've had Everglades mercury problems, which they've managed to make some progress on. Now we have a new mercury source. We have a 240-pound mercury limit in the proposed Baltimore incinerator. That's more than any coal plant emits in total in the state. And I'm talking about coal plants that are much, much larger in terms of the amount of electricity they generate. If you look at the pollution on a per megawatt basis, each unit of electricity, you get about the same nitrogen oxide emissions. That's a smog-forming pollutant per unit of electricity as you do from a coal plant. You get a lot more fine particle pollution.
So, Danielle, considering the kinds of concerns Eric has raised, why do you think it is that you've got new plants going up around the country?
Well, I do think power production does result from the release of greenhouse gas emissions. I'm not quite sure that I can agree with the exact levels comparative to from a waste-to-energy plant with a coal plant. I believe that the emissions are less. But I think that the fact is that waste-to-energy plants do resolve both a methane problem that results in landfills, the landfill problem itself, which is that We're hauling garbage hundreds and hundreds of miles. The amounts of landfills that we have are, we have fewer landfills, but they're much bigger. And so while this county is importing garbage for its waste to energy plant, many municipalities are exporting their garbage hundreds and hundreds of miles to reach a landfill. I do think that it's important to consider what the alternative is to a broader concept of a waste to energy plant to other forms of energy production. So if an area is considering a waste to energy plant, they should also be thinking about, are they replacing a dirtier source of energy pollution? Are they reducing the methane that would be emitted from a landfill? Are they reducing the emissions associated with hauling that garbage all over the country?
What are the kinds of things going into those landfills that would be taken care of by this garbage to energy incinerator?
Well, that might be a better question for Covanta, but I've actually seen a waste to energy plant and taken a tour of one, and a lot of it is household trash that you would personally put on your curb or in your dumpster if you live in an apartment building. Now, ideally, you would have taken out your recyclables before you put that trash in your garbage can or dumpster. But from what I saw in the facility, many of the things that were being put in into the general waste that went to a waste energy facility
were also recyclable.
A lot of paper, a lot of plastic, although not every plastic is recyclable. And I have to say, I agree with Eric that I think we can and should do more to increase our recycling rates. But the fact is, if we doubled our recycling rates and we doubled the amount of municipal waste that went to waste to energy, we would still have leftover municipal waste to deal with. So I think that there's room for both.
Here's an email. Actually, Dave posted this on our Facebook page. He says, as one who suffers adult-onset asthma, I'm firmly opposed to incinerators. While the fact I live near a trash incinerator in Maryland may or may not be the cause of my asthma, it provided an impetus for me to learn about incinerators. There is no upside to trash incineration. They put tons of particulate matter into the air we breathe. They are more expensive than any other type of energy creation, and the process results in highly toxic bags that filter the emissions, and that toxic ash has to be landfilled. Paul Gilman, why don't you take those one at a time?
Frankly, there's not a lot there that's accurate.
Putting particulate matter into the air.
Yeah, researchers at the US EPA have done published papers that show that the particulate matter generated in producing electricity from municipal solid waste is less than that's produced from coal-fired power plants, oil, and even for those landfills that do generate electricity with the gas that's produced in them, the emissions are even lower than from those landfills.
Of course, we are in the process of trying to lower the amount of coal that we use
Absolutely.
In this country.
Absolutely. And in fact, a little story, when I worked at EPA, the specialist for mercury emissions from the NRDC came to see me and urged that we look at using the same technology that the municipal solid waste energy producing plants use to reduce mercury emissions on the coal-fired power plants. That's just now starting to be adopted through the regulations of the EPA. It's been in place since the year 2000 for the energy from waste facilities.
All right. Second point he makes is they are more expensive than any other type of energy creation.
And again, that's not accurate. For example, the facility we just opened in the Durham, York region of Canada near Toronto, produces electricity at 8 cents a kilowatt hour. Wind electricity is 13 cents. Photovoltaic electricity is on the order of 80 cents. And the average price during the peak use of day in that region is 14 cents to the retail customer. So the power produced, when you take into account the other revenue sources at the plant, the metals recovery, the disposal of the waste, the net price of the electricity is very competitive, in fact.
I would think as more windmills show up and more solar energy is produced, those prices
yes, they
will
are,
go
they
down.
Are coming. The good news is
absolutely.
They are coming down. Yes.
The final point he makes is the process results in highly toxic bags that filter the emission, and that toxic ash has to be landfilled.
One of the things that that we do at the facilities is continuously test the ash to see whether or not it's toxic. That, in fact, is a test that's prescribed by the US EPA. And all of the facilities we operate meet that test, so no toxic ash is disposed of.
Eric, can you speak to that?
I don't understand that in the sense that the ash does have toxins in it, and if there's enough leaching, if it's saturated and the leachate breaks through a liner, you're going to have some contaminants. But I want to just jump back to the air issue. I don't want to try your listeners' patience with all these numbers, but they are available online. I would encourage everyone to check them out. You can look at the permit limits for new projects like Energy Answers. You can look at the amount of electricity they claim they'll generate, and then you can look at the data for coal plants as well and compare them.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Going to open the phones now, 800-433-8850. First to Baltimore, Maryland. Craig, you're on the air.
Hi. Our new plants, defined plants where the instead of processing waste into something that could be used by an already existing coal-fired plant, or capturing the methane and piping it to a gas turbine electrical generator. And why start up something from scratch? Why a $750 million setup in Florida instead of retrofitting already existing generation to also run off of dried out waste?
What do you think, Paul?
There are some projects that, in fact, do that. There are some projects that also look at generating liquid transportation fuels from waste. Thinking of waste as a resource, thinking of waste as something that we should maximize our materials recovery from, once we've done that, then recover our energy, is really the most sustainable way to approach this.
All right. To Kara in Indianapolis, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you, Diane. I'm the executive director of the Indiana Recycling Coalition, and we have a Covanta incinerator here in Indianapolis. And our concern is not some of the environmental concerns that other folks have brought up, but it's really when an incinerator contract hurts recycling in a community. For the past many years here in Indianapolis, our contract with Covanta sets a minimum disposal amount, and if we don't send that amount of trash to the incinerator, we're penalized, taxpayers are penalized. So we've been paying several hundred thousand dollars per year penalty, which of course then disincentivizes the city from providing new recycling or expanded recycling services. Because then we'd be hit twice. We'd be making that investment in a new service, but we would also be paying even a higher penalty.
Paul.
When facilities are first established, there are those kinds of provisions. It's sort of you can pay the mortgage, if you will, the loans to build the facilities. As facilities go on, those sorts of fees are phased out typically.
What about that, Eric?
I think it's a really important point. I think everybody agrees at the table that it's better to recycle back into product things like plastic, tires, newspaper. That's the best thing for the environment, and it's the best thing for global warming. I can't say enough that these incinerators compete with recycling. They need plastic, they need paper to burn in order to operate well.
All right, short break here. We'll talk more about that when we come back. Stay with us.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, working to improve the quality of people's lives by supporting the performing arts, the environment, medical research, and child well-being. Information is available at ddcf.org. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working together to build a culture of health for all, on the web at rwjf.org. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about California's drought and water wars with journalist Mark Arax, who's writing a book on the subject. His family farmed in the San Joaquin Valley, but his father gave up farming for running grocery stores and then opened a nightclub where he was murdered in 1972. Arax spent years investigating the murder. We'll talk about that too. Join us.
And welcome back. Here's an email from Dr. George Thurston. He's professor of environmental medicine and population health at New York University. He says, I served on a National Academy of Science committee on incineration a few years back, our report was waste incineration and public health. One of our key findings was that in part because of their burning variations, as trash input varies in composition, these plants are too susceptible to periods when pollution control equipment fails to operate properly and emissions skyrocket for short periods of time. These can represent acute health risks to the surrounding population and can cumulatively add up very fast to increase the annual emission rates greatly above the expected emissions of these plants. Eric.
We spend a lot of time on monitoring issues. They're very important. One thing the public doesn't realize is when you're trying to figure out whether these companies are actually doing what the permit requires, that's often done with an annual test that is run under ideal circumstances. as though you were, you know, you were tested for speeding. The only way you could get a ticket is if you made an appointment with a policeman and drove past him, and he'd sign off and say you were under the speed limit. That's how we test for a lot of pollution. It's a once a year, sometimes not even that much test, run under idealized conditions. You have all kinds of things going into trash burners, and what you get on one day is, as the expert has just said, is not at all what you might see coming out of the stack the next day.
I gather you were opposed to the proposed waste-to-energy incinerator in Baltimore because of its emission standards?
Well, I think it's fair to say that a lot of people in the community were opposed. We were there to provide some legal and technical support. What we wanted in that case is to make sure that they were meeting all the Clean Air Act limits and that the emission numbers were true. They were real. They were valid. They were based on how the plant was going to operate. I don't know if that facility is ever going to see the light of day. It's struggling to get financing. I'm not clear yet whether it's going to be able to meet its limits, and in that case, it may not get built.
What about that, Paul?
Well, first of all, there are continuous emission monitoring systems in place on the facility, and they're used to indicate whether or not there are upsets. I'm very familiar with Professor Thurston's study. I was head of the organization under which that study was done at the time at the National Academy of Sciences. And it did not, in fact, state that there was as a matter that there was a concern over those kinds of emissions. And I think we have 30 years of operation on hundreds of plants that would demonstrate that's not the case. I just, in fact, yesterday had a story come through over letsrecycle.com. It was a 10-year study done by the European Union looking to see if pollutants were in greater concentration among crops grown near these kinds of facilities versus elsewhere. And after the 10-year study, it found no difference in the levels of pollution associated with those facilities.
All right. Let's go to Rennie here in Washington, D.C. You're on the air.
Hello. And my concern is my father-in-law is actually a bankruptcy lawyer. And my concern is at least two cities have cited incineration as reasons that they have filed, part of the reason that they have filed bankruptcy, and that would be Detroit, Michigan, and Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. So I just feel like to say that incineration is cost-effective, I just don't believe it. So,
well, we have seen those examples very recently. They are very expensive. If you think about it, what $1 billion might get you in terms of recycling, you know, that's one way to think about it. You're putting $1 billion into a plant that needs to get garbage at a high rate of speed in order to be profitable. They find out they can't get enough feed. They penalize people under contracts. They reach outside the county, which means you're hauling it from further away.
So what happened in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania?
Well, it's a very sad tale, but it is a sad tale about the performance of the facility and its ability to generate revenues. What happened in Harrisburg, and it's currently under investigation, and I think the results of that will be forthcoming very shortly, city officials continued to refinance the facility and pull cash out of that refinancing to use in the general performance of the city.
Saying they purchased it on loan when they really couldn't afford it?
Well, it's very much like if you were to remortgage your house and continue to remortgage it to the point where you couldn't afford to pay the mortgage each month. And that's literally what took place for the Harrisburg.
But how does a company like Covanta determine whether a city that proposes to buy one of these incinerators can actually afford it before you sell it to them?
Well, in the case of Harrisburg, they built that facility originally for $15 million. They ultimately had it mortgaged for over $240 million. And they recently sold it for $130 million. So that's a set of finances that I don't think anybody who owns a home or takes out a loan could understand.
That makes sense to me.
No, that's exactly why the city was having difficulty paying the
You're
mortgage,
saying
literally.
It was the city's fault and had nothing to do with the purchase of the...
The city owned the facility, and the city hired people to operate the facility, but it was the city's bonds that financed the facility.
Eric, can you say anything about this?
Let's take a modern incinerator, waste energy plant, the Palm Beach plant, with all the bells and whistles. The revenue estimates for that plant, the original projections, are dropping. And I think the number was $18 million out of $45 million projected. That's before it's either just begun operating or it's going to begin operating this summer. So from the get-go, the money they expected in return from that plant is starting to fade away. And the problem with these plants is they're huge. You're making a very big bet. If that bet doesn't pay off, if you don't get the economics you think, the public is left with a big bill to pay.
All right. Let's go to Toledo, Ohio. Hi there, Jordan.
Hi, Diane. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This is kind of a branch off of the comments from the lady from Indiana, kind of related, in that earlier on it was talked about the decline in recycling, and I was wondering how that is related to any tax subsidies given to corporations to produce new products. Like right now, for example, it's cheaper to make new paper than it is to recycle it.
Danielle, can you comment?
I do think our incentives for recycling are not as strong as they could be. You know, I once lived in a city where we had free recycling but paid to get our garbage hauled away. And it's a simple solution that really forced people who had no interest in recycling, I think, to think twice. But similarly, I think that we think of landfills as a cost-effective way of dealing with our garbage when really the resulting cost is incredibly great when we consider how the methane emissions are a climate forcer and the incredible expenses that are going to be associated with a changing climate.
All right, to Diane in Chelsea, Michigan, you're on the air.
Hi, I would like to address the ash issue, and it seems like an overall positive is that you are consolidating the waste, and then it has been proven that there are microbial and fungal methods, you know, meaning like mushrooms and other bacteria and things that have been proven out. There is a good TED talk by Paul Stamets on six ways mushrooms can save the world. So that once you have your waste consolidated, I think that there are methods to take care of the harm, you know, the toxins.
Is that so, Paul?
Well, there are biological systems that are used in different versions of energy recovery from wastes. Absolutely true. Anaerobic digestion is a form of energy recovery.
All right. And to, let's see, Dan in Lafayette, Indiana. You're on the air.
Good morning. Always a fine show.
Thanks.
And in these discussions, I sometimes wonder why we don't talk about the other end of the problem, which is the trash that we generate or get and then have to recycle, i.e. manufacturing and especially like product packaging and so forth. For instance, I get three prescriptions a month from a national drugstore chain. And I tried to talk to them about it, and they wouldn't do anything, but I get three plastic bottles that are put into three bags with large sheets of drug information.
I know exactly what you mean, Danielle.
Absolutely. I think there are a lot of things that we could do to reduce the amount of waste that's produced. Shipping, it drives me crazy, too. I also have a young child at home, and if anybody has ever bought a child's toy and seen the intense amount of plastic packaging that goes around
Absolutely.
It, it's enough to just make you want your child to play with dirt and rocks all day long. But, you know, there are a lot of initiatives and laws that could be passed, and I encourage people to start advocating for them. We could make all plastic in the U.S. used commonly recyclable. We could argue for more biodegradable packaging and minimize packaging. We could set state recycling standards, kind of similar to what the EU is doing now with the EU membership countries, where they're telling these countries that they have to have a set recycling rate.
How many states have that set?
In the U.S.?
Uh-huh.
None that I know of.
None.
None that I'm aware of.
A number of states have goals. And programs in place
to try and drive. Absolute standards.
Well,
in the end,
it's the most important thing to do is to educate the consumer
Absolutely.
Of goods, the homeowner, as the importance of recycling.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. To Tom in Baltimore, Maryland, you're on the air.
Good morning, Miss Diane.
Hi.
I'd like to comment on, I live in Baltimore, and they want to propose a waste-to-energy plant in a neighborhood called Curtis Bay. Now, Curtis Bay is an extremely depressed neighborhood in the city. Very lot of poor people down there, high crime rate, et cetera, et cetera. Not much in the way of economics for people. The plant is going to be located within a mile of a complex for middle schools and elementary schools, within a half mile of residential neighborhoods. Now, when trucks go in to take this recycling material to this plant, they're going to be diesel trucks. Diesel trucks put out carbon particulate matter. And I don't know if that's been calculated into the formula of what this plant emits, but it should be calculated into it.
Paul.
Yeah. When a state goes into a permitting process, that is the very kind of thing, all the transportation associated sorts of activities and the like. There are ways to improve upon that. Montgomery County, Maryland's a good example where they use rail to transport their waste. New York City is beginning to go in that direction as well.
Yeah, but it's also the location of the plant itself.
That's right. And siting is always a controversial topic for any activity. We believe as a company that you have to have the community completely involved in the process. We've developed a community outreach.
But why would you put it in the poorest center of town and have it near a middle school where young people are?
That's the very kind of siting issue that the community has
You're
to be completely engaged in.
You're saying you have nothing to do with that.
Well, when you do propose a new facility, those are the very issues you have to bring to the fore and make sure there's a consensus in the community.
Eric.
So let's talk about permitting and siting. The state has a requirement that says you cannot build an incinerator or waste energy plant within a mile of a school. They waive that requirement for this plant.
Baltimore City waived it.
No, the state. The state waived it. So much for the siting restriction. Why? Because the governor wanted to get it built, because, you know, political folks like to cut ribbons and so on. But those permitting requirements don't quite get implemented when you get down to ground level and you see what actually happens when these permits are written. You're also talking about a very high source of fine particle pollution in a city that has much higher than average asthma rates and a pollutant that causes premature death. You've got a permit limit of 150 tons of fine particles in an area that really can't take that much. And I'm not counting the diesel traffic. I'm just looking at what's coming out of the stack. So putting this in the green energy category seems to me to really be distorting vocabulary and confusing the debate.
Danielle.
Well, I don't support waiving siting requirements, but I would say that when you take a broader perspective, that what kind of energy a waste-to-energy plant could be replacing. If it's replacing a coal plant, then you're replacing particulate matter. You're replacing other GHGs that are, if not, that are more have more adverse health effects than the waste-to-energy plant.
Is that
it's just simply not true. As somebody who spent a lot of time on the permit, the particulates that they are permitted to release at the Energy Answers plant in Baltimore on a per megawatt basis are higher than what the coal plant emits today.
So another discussion of pros and cons. You've heard it here this morning for the last hour. It's up to citizens to make the decisions, and that's why we do programs like this. Paul Gilman, Danielle Bassan, Eric Schaefer, thank you all so much. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Reed.